least one soldier among us.
I'll join up next year as soon as I'm 17. I wanted to join this year, said Stephen, but Papa wouldn't let me.
I'm sure you'll make a fine soldier, Alex agreed. And it's not too late for you to join our side, Mr. Church.
John Church sat up straighter in his chair.
I think you will agree that I have done much for the Americans, Colonel Hamilton. One out of every 4 bullets fired by an American rifle was procured through me. Yet I remain an Englishman and will not commit treason against my country.
But the bullets we fire are against British soldiers, Alex replied. Does that not distress you?
Of course it does, Church replied. As it should distress you, and all people with an open heart. To see so many of my fellow countrymen cut down in defense of an unjust policy grieves me, yet neither will my conscience allow me to support continued colonial domination. War is a degrading business all around. Thank God it's profitable, or it would have no use whatsoever.
Alex chuckled along with Church and Stephen, though he was not sure if he should be offended. Angelica's beau was either a shrewd man or a buffoon. He wasn't sure which.
I make light of a foul situation, Church parried. But I cannot wait for this war to be over, and to return to England. It is my hope that we can bring a bit of American-style democracy to our side of the pond.
And Angelica, Alex responded, does she want to bring some American-style democracy to your side of the pond?
It is my fondest wish, he said, glancing over Alex's shoulder.
Alex turned, but it was Eliza who caught his eye. For the first time that evening, she was able to smile directly at him. Alex felt the sudden need to loosen the buttons of his waistcoat. His heart was full to bursting. The door opened. Ulysses entered with Lowe's, the young footman, and after conferring briefly with Mrs. Cochrane, pulled a table out from a wall and set it in the center of the room. Louisa and a chambermaid appeared with china, plate, and linens, and set it quickly, as the men stood and allowed their chairs to be pressed into service, while chairs were brought for the women's side as well. Mrs. Cochrane's wing chair was pushed to the head of the table, and soon enough, everyone was seated in front of steaming bowls of stew. To Alex's dismay, though, he was seated directly across from Peggy, with Angelica in the middle and Eliza at the far end. Church was seated next to him and Stephen across from Eliza.
"Colonel Hamilton," Angelica said, almost before they had begun eating. "We have been seeing a great deal of you lately, or should I say, my sister Eliza has been seeing a great deal of you."
Alex felt his cheeks warm. "Not nearly as much as I would like," he said quietly, and dipped his spoon into his stew.
"Is that so? Then are we to conclude that you have proper intentions toward our sister?"
Alex struggled to keep his spoon steady as he brought it to his mouth. He chewed and swallowed slowly, hoping that someone would speak, but the table remained silent save for the occasional clink of metal and china.
"I would not like to characterize my feelings toward Miss Schuyler in public, if that is all right with you."
"Dear me, Eliza," Angelica continued, turning to her sister. "I hope he has more gumption on the battlefield than he does with females, or the war is doomed."
Eliza didn't meet her sister's eye or Alex's.
"Like I said, I hope Colonel Hamilton has more gumption on the battlefield than in courtship if he is hesitant to publicly announce his affection. Why, I told Mr. Church he was too old and too short for me the first time we met, and he still told everyone that he was going to marry me."
"I believe you said I was too fat, too," Church said, laughing and rubbing his belly.
"I have grown very fond of your softnesses," Angelica said coyly, "though take care that they remain firm softnesses, as it were, and do not begin to sag. I should not like it if I were seen on the arm of a man who drooped."
"Oh, Angelica, you are too saucy," Aunt Gertrude said.
though it was unclear whether she was amused or outraged.
He would not speak so if Dr. Cochrane were here.
What did she say that was so saucy? Stephen asked.
She just said she didn't want a man who...
He clapped a hand over his mouth, less than quick on the uptake in social settings.
I don't know, Alex said now. I don't think a man should presume too much. A proposal isn't a battlefield charge, after all. It's much more a game of diplomacy.
Eliza smiled at him when he said this, but Alex's gaze was caught by Angelica's. She had the strangest look on her face, of determination mixed with chagrin. It was as if she were determined to put him on the spot, yet she also felt guilty about it.
She is under some external pressure, Alex said to himself. I can only hope she manages to resist it a little more effectively than she has been.
Alas, after another moment of hesitancy, Angelica drew a deep breath, as if preparing a second salvo. The more significant absence tonight is that of our parents, who, though they have some knowledge of Colonel Hamilton, you remember he tried to have Papa thrown in jail last year? Do not know nearly enough about him to judge whether he is a suitable candidate for one of their daughters.
Angelica, please, Eliza said now. You are being too bold.
Another pause on Angelica's part. Another flash of pain on the tightly drawn features of her face.
Sometimes boldness is necessary, Angelica said. You have never had any sense when it comes to men, and if someone else doesn't look out for you, you will end up penniless and cooking your own food.
It is the parents, Alex said to himself. It must be.
I assure you that I would cook for Miss Schuyler if it came to that, he said, attempting levity.
I have no doubt you would, Angelica said, by which I mean that I have no doubt that you probably do know how to cook, as you were raised without benefit of servants, or, if I understand correctly, without benefit of family.
Alex's eyes widened. He did not know that he had ever been spoken to so bluntly in his life, or at least since he had arrived in the North, and certainly not by a lady.
My father traveled, he said, choosing a word that was not, at the most literal level, a lie, and my mother was taken home when I was quite young. I was raised by friends of the family. My family were but recent immigrants to the West Indies and alone there, and it was impractical to send me back to Scotland.
Well, one certainly can't fault your resourcefulness, Angelica admitted. You have certainly made a name for yourself and done great service to your country, despite the fact that you come from, well, nothing.
Alex startled and coughed.
I must say, Miss Schuyler, I have never had a compliment feel quite so much like a knife in the bowels.
Angelica colored beneath her powder.
Oh, damn it all.
Peggy tittered. Eliza gasped. Aunt Gertrude reached for a glass and downed it in a single quaff.
Good God, Miss Schuyler,
Stephen said, the urgency of his words undone by a squeak in his voice.
Have you quite lost your senses?
Angelica put her left hand on Eliza's right and squeezed visibly, but her eyes were trained on Alex.
You must know, Colonel Hamilton, how inordinately fond we all are of you. Even my father, whom you tried to imprison, has nothing but praise for the alacrity with which you performed your duties. But I am honor-bound to remind you that the Schuylers are one of the oldest families in New York, with connections to the Van Rensselaers, the Van Cortlands, and the Livingstons on our mother's and father's sides. Your own people do not have the same depth as do ours, neither of blood, nor, more pointedly, of pocket. To see my sister wedded to a man whom she loves and admires would give me nothing but joy. But you can't possibly expect to claim her with a bag of oranges, can you?
Alex glanced at Eliza to see how she reacted to her sister's words. She was clearly aghast, and Alex took this as a sign that Angelica's words, if ostensibly on Eliza's behalf, were not also at her behest. Peggy and Stephen looked embarrassed, whereas Aunt Gertrude's eyes, when they met his, were positively heartbroken. But the most unhappy person at the table, save perhaps him, was clearly Angelica. And Alex was once again convinced that she spoke on behalf of someone else. It could only be General and Mrs. Schuyler.
"Miss Schuyler," he said then, turning back to the eldest sister. "At the risk of public hubris, may I remind you that I am the chief aide-de-camp to His Excellency General George Washington, the Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. On his behalf, and on behalf of our country, I have corresponded with the representatives of no fewer than 4 kings, 13 princes, 21 dukes, 47 earls, and more marquises and counts and knights-errant than you could fit on the island of Manhattan. Further, in my defense, my name, I tell you, and not my father's or my grandfather's or some other moldering ancestor, my own name is known to every American of any distinction whatsoever, from Ambassador Franklin to Thomas Jefferson and James Madison to John Adams and John Hancock to John Jay. Why, even Patrick Henry and Robert Morris know me by name. And it is by their high standards and not by a list of names in a kirkyard that I judge myself and expect others to judge me."
Angelica listened to Alex rattle off his list with a growing smile on her face. That put her in her place, he thought. But he had underestimated the eldest Schuyler sister.
"That's quite an impressive roster of names, sir," she said when he had finished. "It sounds like my mother's Christmas card list."
It took Alex a moment to realize she was toying with him. Christmas cards? But it was not until Peggy tittered and Eliza covered her eyes with her hands that he realized her joke had undone all the work of his list of accomplishments and contacts. The reaction from the others came gradually, with Church spitting out an uneasy chuckle, while Stephen searched everyone's facial expressions for clues as to how to respond. When Aunt Gertrude joined in with an almost masculine guffaw, Alex realized Angelica's trick had hit its mark again. But someone came to his rescue.
"Oh, come now, Angelica. You know Mama has only ever corresponded with 2 kings, and one of those was an exile from some Italian isle that is hardly larger than the pastures," said Eliza, setting the joke squarely back on her sister.
Alex smiled, relieved, and the merriment gradually ran its course, and the rest of the evening passed in a noisy swirl of cigars and hard cider. He made the effort to be the bon vivant, but Angelica had unintentionally struck his Achilles heel. It was true. He belonged to no one. It was nearing midnight when Alex headed toward the coat closet, steeling himself for the cold outside air. Angelica rounded the corner like a night hawk and caught his arm, fixing him with a smile that was both challenging and a little sad.
"In truth, Colonel Hamilton," she said, "you haven't got a penny to your name, do you? A pity, for it appears you are quite taken with my sister, and it bereaves me to say that the feeling is mutual. Alas."
And for the second time in his life, Alex found himself struck speechless by a Schuyler girl. 24. Mother's News. Eliza's Bedroom, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. With Aunt Gertrude tucked away all cozy in bed, Eliza pulled both sisters into her second-floor room. She shook her head and punched a pillow, bouncing on the bed.
"Angelica Schuyler," Eliza began. "What were you thinking?"
Angelica sighed and didn't say anything for a long moment, then pulled a letter from her purse and handed it to her sister in silence.
"You need to hear this, too," she said to Peggy. "It concerns all of us.
It was chilly in the room, and Peggy joined Eliza beneath blankets that had been warmed by a brazier. Angelica slipped behind a screen and began changing into her night clothes as Eliza read their mother's letter aloud.
"My dear Angelica, I write to you as the eldest of my daughters, not because I think that the information I am going to share with you is the sort of thing that a girl of your age should concern herself with, but because there are times when a girl of any age must concern herself with things that seem masculine or foreign or otherwise unpleasant. I speak frankly when I say that you are not as intelligent or educated as your sister Elizabeth, but you possess a capacity for captaincy that she, who is independent rather than a true leader, does not. I therefore confide this information to you with the trust that you will see that it is put to its proper use. I am informed by General Schuyler that though the house at Saratoga has been rebuilt and the fields and orchards replanted, the harvests have not yet reached fruition, and as a result the farm is consuming far more money than it is bringing in. General Schuyler has considered selling it, but there is no one in these conditions of uncertainty who is willing to pay even a tenth of its worth, and parting with it would only be cutting off one's nose to spite one's face. Additionally, General Schuyler has not received his stipend from the Continental Congress for nearly 2 years, and though there is every reason to believe that he will be rewarded amply with land and other in-kind goods when the war is concluded, it is impossible to say when that day will come, or even if it will be decided in our favor. What I am trying to say, my dearest daughter, is that we are on the verge of ruin. It is therefore imperative that you and your sisters marry immediately and marry well. In this regard, only Margarita is fulfilling her duty, but Master Van Rensselaer is still some years away from attaining his majority. Though the connections between his family and ours go back several generations, I worry that the patroon will discover to what circumstances we have been reduced and will call off the engagement. So great is my fear that I urge you not to share this information with Peggy, who has not the discretion the Almighty gave to a screech owl, and is likely to unnecessarily share this information with young Stephen, who would then be well within his rights to communicate it to his father. "Mama," Peggy exclaimed, when Eliza reached this point, "you libel me."
"Oh, hush," Eliza said. "You know you're an unrepentant gossip." Peggy hushed. It was true. "As for you, Angelica, I am going to advise you to do something that directly contravenes General Schuyler's wishes for you, and, as such, causes me no amount of consternation. Though Mr. Church's family connections remain hazy to us, as do his business dealings and debts from his time in England, his successes here in America are plain enough to assess. Even General Schuyler has admitted that though he dislikes Mr. Church personally, the man is remarkably adept at providing munitions to the Continental Army at reasonable prices while simultaneously retaining a handsome profit for himself. I am told by both General Schuyler and other sources that those profits number in the thousands, and as such they outweigh any marks against him. Therefore, it is with a heavy heart I am advising you, nay, directing you, to accept his offer of marriage and to finalize the union post-haste. If necessary, you should elope with him, for though the news will wound your father, the general will take comfort in the fact that you are paired with a man whom you respect and who can provide for you and ease the lot of his relations."
"Angelica," Eliza called to her sister behind the privacy screen. "Are you really going to do it? Are you going to elope?"
"Keep reading," Angelica grunted as she writhed free from her dress. "We will discuss everything when you have finished." Which brings us to Elizabeth. We sent her to Morristown with the expectation that she would meet some suitable young gentleman among the many officers in General Washington's entourage, but it has come to my attention via Gertrude
that Eliza has allowed her time to be monopolized by that nameless and penniless scoundrel Hamilton, who only last year oversaw the prosecution of dear Papa for crimes against his country, even though he was exonerated on all charges. I do not wish to go into that again.
Undoubtedly, it is a testament to your father's goodness of character and breeding that he speaks in the highest terms of Colonel Hamilton's intelligence and potential, despite that fellow's transgressions against him. Nevertheless, Colonel Hamilton is an unacceptable candidate. Suffice it to say, as a woman, I judge him with my heart and my purse. My heart does not forgive him for what he did to your father, and my purse hangs empty at my side. He will not fill it. In short, he will not do. And since Eliza is making no attempt to find a more suitable beau, I have decided to take matters into my own hands. I have been in correspondence with Susanna Livingston, the wife of Governor William Livingston and mother to your friends Kitty and Sarah. Their brother Henry is the same age as Eliza and has served as aide-de-camp to both General Schuyler and Major General Benedict Arnold, who led our boys to victory at Saratoga and regained for us our once and future beloved estate. Though his efforts on behalf of his country are nothing less than commendable, Mrs. Livingston tells me that she has seen certain signs of restlessness in Colonel Livingston, and indeed indications of incipient waywardness that suggest he is in want of a wife to cut short these libertine tendencies before they can become true vices. To that end, Mrs. Livingston and I mutually agree that it is in both families' best interest if he and Eliza marry immediately.
No!
Eliza cried out, pressing the letter into Peggy's hands. There were two or three more paragraphs, but Eliza couldn't bear to read further.
"Angelica,"
she called in a forlorn voice,
"is it... oh, can it be true? Am I to marry Henry Livingston?"
It was Peggy who answered her.
"Mama's letter says he arrives on the 24th. That is tomorrow. He will only be in Morristown for 1 week. She wants the business concluded before he leaves."
The business, Eliza thought grimly, as though I were so many bushels of corn to be sold at market.
"I have not seen Henry in some years," Peggy said, squeezing her hands. "But Kitty wrote me last winter to say that he had turned out a fine young man."
"He pulled my pigtails," Eliza said dazedly. "When we visited the Livingstons in Elizabethtown when I was 11, Henry would sneak up on me and pull my pigtails from beneath my bonnet." She looked at her sister forlornly.
"That is all I know about my future husband."
"You know he's rich," Angelica said, stepping out from behind the screen. "What more do you need to know?" Eliza looked up in surprise to see that her older sister had not changed into her nightgown, but into a simple traveling dress in dark wool, without corset or bustle.
"Sister, what are you doing?"
Angelica shrugged. The look on her face was one of defiant resolution.
"I am doing what Mama directed me to do. I am eloping." "What? Tonight? That cannot be."
"John sends the carriage for me at midnight. We will travel to Elizabethtown, and Governor Livingston himself will perform the ceremony. Not even Papa can object if his daughter is married by a governor. We travel thence to Philadelphia, where John is establishing a base for his business so that it can better cater to both North and South."
"But Angelica, you cannot marry like a milkmaid in trouble in front of a judge in a plain wool dress. You must have a trousseau and a dowry and a wedding at home like Mama and Papa's, in bright silks, with family gathered around you."
Angelica smiled benignly. "That will be your wedding, dear Eliza."
"I will not marry Henry Livingston. I do not even know him."
"That may be so, but you won't marry Colonel Hamilton either. Mama and Papa will not allow it. They cannot afford it."
Eliza was aghast. And you can't elope, either. This last from Peggy forlornly. What do you mean? Eliza said, turning to her younger sister. Mama writes that she worried that you might attempt to run off with Colonel Hamilton, but Papa assures her that Colonel Hamilton's own sense of decorum will prevent such an outcome. She says he feels too much loyalty to Papa as a fellow soldier in the cause of revolution to betray his trust in such a manner. His guilt at being forced to prosecute Papa last year will only reinforce his desire not to further harm a man whom he esteems so greatly. Even as Eliza turned her back to Peggy's words, she knew they were true. Alex was too honorable to steal a man's daughter, especially the daughter of a man he had been forced against his will to do harm. She was trapped. Besides, as Angelica pointed out at the dinner table, Alex had yet to declare his courtship or define his intentions concerning their relationship, whatever they were. So now she was going to have to marry Henry Livingston, a boy she had last seen nearly a decade ago when he had pulled her pigtails until her head was so wobbly she thought it would fall from her neck. "If he so much as touches my hair now," she said out loud, "I swear I'll cut his hands off." 25. No guts, no glory. Continental Army Headquarters, Morristown, New Jersey, March 1780. The news of Angelica Schuyler's elopement with John Barker Church made the rounds of the Morristown encampment with the magical haste of gossip. Upon hearing the news, General Washington remarked to Alex that if he could learn of British troop movements with the same speed as he learned of love affairs, he would have won the war 2 years ago. In the long run, few were surprised that the marriage had finally come to pass after Mr. Church's extended courtship. To the degree that people were familiar with the character of Miss Schuyler that was, she was understood to be a brilliant young woman who would only accept a husband who could gain her access to the very highest levels of society. And John Barker Church, despite the questions that remained about his past, was obviously the kind of man who could provide it. If his bearing was not quite as martial or athletic as some other young men's, he had the wooer's gift of giving a girl his undivided attention. Of flattery, yes, and the sorts of gifts and romance that the modern girl expects from a suitor, but also of genuine interest in the things that held a girl's fancy. Where another man would be content to charge a lady's maid with procuring a bolt of cloth from which a dress could be made, Mr. Church would not only pick out the fabric himself, but commission a seamstress to craft the most flattering cut for his belle. If a girl expressed an interest in Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, he would gift on her a complete set of the Englishman's work, including even the scandalous Moll Flanders. "They are well met," Lafayette said to Alex when he heard the news. "You will keep her on her toes, but she will keep him honest as well. It will be a tempestuous marriage, but if they can handle each other's tempers, I predict a successful union." Alex had found the news out from Eliza herself. She had written him a brief note, apologizing for Angelica's outburst at the dinner table, saying that her elder sister was feeling the pressure of the coming elopement, which had occurred that very evening. The words were obviously meant to mollify him, yet the notes being addressed to Colonel Hamilton rather than to Alex, and signed, "Yours very sincerely, Miss E. Schuyler," instead of "Yours, Eliza," left him on pins and needles. More devastating, she pointedly did not encourage him to visit her or make any mention of coming to see him. Perhaps Angelica's words had had their effect on her? Regardless of Angelica's motivations for speaking so bluntly to him, Alex knew that she was right. The Schuylers would expect Eliza to marry someone rich. Indeed, she and they deserved it. The family had worked hard for three generations to establish and increase their status as one of the first families of the northern states, and they would not grant access to their inner circle to just anyone. To be sure, the New World was a place where a man could come from nothing and become a person of great power and wealth. Look at Benjamin Franklin, who had started out a humble printer's apprentice, yet became one of the wealthiest men in America. But Alex had not Mr. Franklin's scientific mind. He would not invent a kind of spectacles or a type of stove, let alone discover something as momentous as electricity itself. He had only his wits, his ability to see through to the heart of a situation quickly, and to render that truth persuasively in words. Such a talent boded well for a career in law or in public service, perhaps even newspapering or literature. But none of those paths was a route to quick wealth, and he could not propose to Eliza, let alone to her parents, on the basis of some hypothetical future success. However, Alex did have a head for numbers as well. After his mother died, he had been apprenticed as a clerk in the mercantile house of Beekman and Kruger. There he discovered a flair for keeping books and anticipating the movements of the market and knowing when to sell and buy to maximize profit. Alex had been all of 14 at the time. To him, it was a game, but many men made careers of this kind of trading, and fortunes. It was base work, to be sure, devoid of glory and full of questionable morality as well. What man wants to make his living peddling the vices of tobacco or alcohol to the besotted, or manipulating the price of vital goods such as grain or mutton, so that he would profit greatly while his thousands of customers might lose? But if he didn't do it, someone else would. And yet, could he give up everything just for Eliza? Could he be miserable in business for the sake of a happy wife? And would she be happy if he were miserable? It seemed to Alex that Eliza did not care for money the way her parents did, or her sisters. It might be that, as a rich girl, she had never had to worry about it. But that was selling her short. She was simply not a material individual, and if she saw Alex throw away his beliefs for the sake of buying her from her family like a piece of livestock, she would lose all respect for him. There was one other way, but it was uncertain and dangerous to boot. In all the world, for all of history, there has always been, for men at least, one aspect of their character worth more than money, and that was glory, the kind of glory that only valor on the battlefield can gain. Horses churning beneath a soldier's body as swords flash and rifles sound and bullets cut the air. To risk one's life for a worthy cause, and what cause was more worthy than democracy, was the kind of endeavor that made a man beloved of his fellow countrymen, and granted him influence in the highest circles, whether it be government or industry or society. Glory brought fortune more surely than an investment in gold bullion or Barbados rum. And unlike those other endeavors, it brought respect, too. The kind of respect that even the Schuylers must surely acknowledge. And though Lawrence and Lafayette liked to tease him for clerking away the war while other men his age risked their lives, Alex had been on the battlefield. As General Washington's chief aide-de-camp, he was never more than a few feet away from the center of command. But a modern general did not ride into the fray like a medieval king. He stood apart, usually on a hill or other prominence, observing the action and directing its course, and his secretaries were likewise sidelined. Alex had been present at battles on a half-dozen occasions, but in every instance save one, he had never drawn his sword or fired his weapon. He had instead taken notes of General Washington's orders, of the enemy's troop movements and the American's response, of requests for aid or supplies. The rules of engagement prohibited firing on commanding officers, although that didn't prevent the occasional mis-aimed cannon from coming dangerously close. But Alex's only real taste of combat had come at the Battle of Monmouth in 1778. When it seemed like Cornwallis's forces would overcome the Americans, General Washington had ridden into battle and Alex had thrown aside his pen and paper and ridden after him. Together, they had rallied the American troops and saved the day. And if the battle ultimately ended in a draw, the result was far better than the rout it could have been. Indeed, it was the first time that American troops had met the British counterparts on an equal basis and held their own, and reports of their bravery had inspired other battalions up and down the line. Alex remembered little about the day, save that it had been unbearably hot. Later, it was discovered that more than half the men who laid dead on the battlefield were not wounded. They had died not of bullets or bayonets, but of the heat itself. General Washington's own horse, a magnificent white charger given to him by the governor of New Jersey, William Livingston, had died of heat stroke, and Alex's own horse had fallen beneath him, from a bullet that could have just as easily killed Alex. The fall knocked him unconscious. His leg and arm had both been badly sprained, though by some miracle neither was broken. When he awakened, he found he had been dragged from the field. His clothes had been soaked in blood, though whether it came from his horse or the enemy, he couldn't have told you. His sword was also blood-stained. But he had no memory of running anyone through. He had been brave, yes, but no stories would be told about a man whose own horse had been the one to remove him from battle. He needed to prove himself once and for all. For himself, for his country, but above all, for Eliza. It was just after 2 o'clock in the afternoon when Alex knocked on the door of the first-floor rear parlor that General Washington had taken as his private office, and let himself in. Your Excellency? Even seated, the blue-coated figure at the square, paper-covered desk cut an imposing figure, with his erect posture and broad shoulders and thick hair heavily dusted with powder. He did not look up immediately, but continued with his writing for some minutes, while Alex waited patiently. At last, the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army placed his quill back in its holder. He sifted a little ash over the sheet of parchment in front of him to soak up any excess ink, then blew the ash to the floor and folded the parchment into thirds. On the outside of the letter he wrote a simple large M, and then, finally, he looked up at Alex with the letter in his outstretched hand.
"For Mrs. Washington," he said.
Alex had already known to whom the letter was intended. The only correspondent to whom General Washington himself wrote was his wife. General Washington turned back to his desk and reached for a passel of letters when he noticed that Alex had not left the room.
"Yes, Colonel. Have I overlooked something?"
"No, Your Excellency," Alex said. "That is, I was hoping that I might have a word with you."
General Washington paused a moment, considering Alex's question as seriously as if he had been asked for a loan of 1,000 shillings, or his decision on whether or not to execute an enemy soldier. At length, he said,
"Tell me what is on your mind, Colonel."
Alex would have liked to sit down, but General Washington was the kind of man who grew only more formal with those whom he spent the most time. There was a joke, a very private joke, that the M he wrote on the outside of letters to his wife was not for Martha, but for Mrs., which was the only name by which anyone had ever heard him refer to her. Alex took a calming breath before addressing his general.
"It is about a matter we discussed last fall. You said that I should bring it up with you this spring."
"Ah,"
Washington said, turning to the window. He gazed out over the snow-spotted boughs of an ash tree, and from thence to the fire in the hearth behind him that barely kept the outside chill at bay.
"It does not look like spring to me."
"It is the 2nd of March, Your Excellency. The ice is cracking in the Passaic and Hudson rivers. The war will resume sooner rather than later."
"Indeed,"
General Washington assented.
"I wonder that you are so eager for the resumption of fighting. Most men would avoid it as long as possible."
"I am eager to fight only inasmuch as the sooner we fight, the sooner we win,
and free ourselves from having to fight again.
Indeed, General Washington repeated. He looked at Alex.
May I assume that you are resuming your petition for a command of your own?
I am, Your Excellency.
You have never commanded a battalion before. Why do you think you are up to the responsibility?
As a youthful country, many of our battlefield commanders have assumed their duties with little or no previous experience. I have learned what I know about war from the best of them all.
Something close to a smile flickered over General Washington's lips.
I would disagree with you, but that would mean admitting that I am not the best of our men, which would smack of false modesty.
The story went that the general was a mirthless man, but this was not entirely true. The general's teeth were notoriously rotten, and he was afraid his dentures would fall from his mouth if he smiled too widely, let alone laughed aloud. Certainly no one had ever seen the general laugh aloud, but Alex suspected the general had just made a joke, though whether at Alex's or his own expense, he couldn't be sure.
I have been present at some of our most contested battles, Alex said now. I know the enemy's tactics, and again, if I may make bold, I know yours as well, not the least of which is your ability to inspire troops with your words and your bravery.
I could not disagree with the first part of that statement, General Washington said, since many of my most inspiring words were written by you. But I will say that there is a fine line between bravery and recklessness. A commander of an army cannot be so fearless that he unnecessarily jeopardizes his own life.
You are referring to Monmouth, Your Excellency.
It is not I who refer to Monmouth, but other soldiers and officers who saw you on the field. None would dispute your bravery, but many would question your ardor.
Alex was about to defend himself when General Washington spoke over him.
Many would, but I do not. Monmouth was a messy affair, and at the end of the day only one thing saved us from defeat, and that was the fighting spirit of our men. I was very proud of you that day.
Thank you, sir, Alex said humbly.
But it is difficult for me to conceive of my own role, of this office, without you by my side. Quite simply, you are too good at your job. You make me a better commander, and that is good for our army and our country.
You flatter me, Your Excellency.
I think you know that I have never flattered anyone in my life, nor, as I have already indicated, am I much impressed by false modesty.
Then allow me to speak immodestly, Your Excellency. For as valuable as my services are to you as a clerk, 100 times more valuable will they be to you on the battlefield, where I can fire off not letters but bullets, and finish off our enemy the only way he will ever truly be vanquished, which is not with ink, but with blood. Other men can craft pretty sentences that persuade men to surrender their money or their supplies, but only a few men can persuade men to give up their lives. I believe I am one of those men, and for the sake of my country I would like the chance to prove it.
Your eloquence is persuasive, Colonel Hamilton, yet it also works against you. For true eloquence is far more rare than bravery. I am not convinced that I could replace you, and more to the point, I do not want to.
Alex felt his heart sink, but he pressed on.
Your Excellency, he said urgently. Would you call yourself a soldier if you had never set foot on the field of battle, but only directed men from a protected promontory? Would you feel that you had served a country as great as this one if you had only written letters like a tradesman, ordering troops about like so many bales of cotton or hay? I know you, sir. I have seen you wade into the thick of the action like an enlisted man, and I know that this experience has made you a better general, because you know what is at stake when you give an order.
Your Excellency, he continued, this nation has the potential to be something that no other country has been, a beacon of freedom and opportunity. But it is as yet very far from realizing those goals, and it never will realize those goals if its men cower behind desks and windows. The war is being fought out there. Alex wound up. And out there is where I need to be.
General Washington absorbed all of this without giving away a clue as to how it was affecting him.
He must be a formidable opponent at the card tables, Alex thought.
At length, the general turned back to his letters.
I make no promises, he said, but I will consider it.
Your Excellency,
Alex said, bowing low, then retreating from the room. He knew he would get no more that day. 26. Timing is everything. Down the street from the Cochrane residence, Morristown, New Jersey, March 1780. That white house in the ash trees is the Ford Mansion, where General Washington maintains his office, Eliza pointed. And that brown house is Jacob Arnold's tavern, where many of the officers take their mess, though for the life of me, I cannot fathom why anyone would refer to food by such an unappetizing name.
If you saw what passed for food in most army camps, Miss Schuyler, you would understand immediately.
Henry Livingston had changed dramatically in the decades since Eliza had seen him last. He had grown into a tall, well-formed young man, with lamb-chop whiskers and a thick head of chestnut hair he kept heavily powdered, in the manner of General Washington himself. His eyes were dark and mercurial, rarely resting on one object for long, be it a house or a painting, or even the face of a young woman. On meeting Eliza at Aunt Gertrude's house, he had said only,
"Well, I guess I won't be pulling your pigtails any more,"
and then walked right past her to the pair of portraits on the far wall.
"I say, are these the Brits who used to live here? What a sad lot they look, huh?"
"The Kitcheners," Eliza said.
"I wonder that Dr. Cochrane keeps their portraits still."
He lifted the portrait of Mrs. Kitchener and peered behind it.
"Aha! I knew it. Wallpaper's all faded. Has to keep these here to cover it."
He regarded Mrs. Kitchener's face rather longer than he had Eliza's.
"Probably wasn't a bad-looking woman in her day. Can only imagine what she thought when she was married off to that old buzzard."
He jerked a thumb at Mr. Kitchener.
"At least you can say your parents didn't sell you off to an old man, or an ugly one, if I do say so myself."
Eliza stared at him blankly. She had never heard a man speak quite so crudely about the marriage contract, least of all about his own. "I'm sure our parents were thinking of our welfare as well as our families when they chose us for each other." Eliza found it hard to say the words aloud.
"It's a nice thought, but I'm pretty sure old Mrs. Schuyler would have made you marry me even if I'd been an ugly cuss twice your age. And I know my mother wouldn't have winked if you'd weighed 15 stone and drooled when you drank your coffee. She's a Schuyler, she would have said."
He mocked, putting on an accent that was even more posh than the one he already affected.
"Her bloodline is impeccable. Well, I'm just glad you're not a hag."
"I... thank you?" Eliza had no idea what to say.
"The dress, though," he said, waving a hand at her blue wool jumper. "I'll get Kitty and Sarah to go fabric shopping with you, or maybe just send you fabric. Something more feminine. As a Livingston, you'll be doing a lot of meeting and greeting, and I'd rather no one mistook you for the housekeeper."
Eliza did her best not to gasp. "Yes, well, my jumper is appropriate to the weather. It is not so cold today, and I thought perhaps you might enjoy a turn about the town after your long carriage journey."
"Absolutely," Henry shrugged. "I mean, if you've seen one town on the eastern seaboard, you've seen them all. House, house, steeple, steeple, village green, cow paddy. But I'm sure you want to show me off."
He grinned crookedly, as if he were making fun of himself, but Eliza decided he was just showing off his grin. An hour later, and Henry's demeanor had not changed.
Everything was too familiar, too old-fashioned, and too quaint. The only time he perked up was when they passed the house on the corner of White Lawn and Ferrier Streets, where even at this early hour a soldier could be seen making his way down the alley to the rear entrance, his hat pulled low over his face.
"Well, I know a house of ill repute when I see one,"
Henry said bluntly.
"If you come looking for me in the middle of the night and I'm not in my bed, you might consider asking for me around there."
"Mr. Livingston,"
Eliza struggled to regain control of her voice,
"I most certainly will not come looking for you in the middle of the night."
"Oh, I'm supposed to come to you, then,"
Henry said, and actually dug his elbow into her ribs.
"You'll play hard to get, and I'll pretend to ravish you. Is that it?"
"Mr. Livingston," Eliza said again, "I find this line of conversation most inappropriate."
"Oh, come on, Eliza. I'm only trying to break the ice. We're going to be married in a week."
"Well, we are not married now. And indeed, we have only known each other for a few hours. I would appreciate a little delicacy before the secrets of the marriage chamber are thrust upon us."
"Thrust being the operative word,"
Henry said, sotto voce. Eliza made to pull away, but Henry had locked his arm in hers.
"Oh, come on, Miss Schuyler. I'm just teasing. I promise to be good for the rest of our walk."
They continued on for 10 more minutes, and if Henry refrained from any more off-color comments, he had not said much of anything else. Indeed, Eliza heard him yawn once. At length, they came to the Ford mansion. Eliza peered up at the stately residence, thinking, "Was it really only a few weeks ago when I was inoculating soldiers against the pox and bantering with Colonel Lawrence and the Marquis de Lafayette and dining with—" But she couldn't bring herself to say his name. It seemed impossible that her life could have been upended so quickly. "Oh, Alex," she thought, staring at the front door and willing it to open. "Where are you? What happened to us? Did Angelica scare you away? I have no care for name or fortune. You are more than enough for me." To her shock, the door opened and Alex flew out in a whirlwind. He ran down the path, but it was only when he was near the end that he seemed to notice her.
Miss Schuyler, I was just coming to see you."
Eliza's heart was beating so fast that she couldn't actually speak.
"How do, Colonel?"
Alex said in a mocking rendition of a southern accent.
"Henry Livingston,"
Alex said, his eyes going wide with shock.
"Is that really you?"
Eliza remembered then. When Alex had first come to the United States, he had stayed with the Livingstons. It was Kitty, Henry's sister, who had first described the young Alex to her. Eliza couldn't help but notice that the two men did not embrace each other. A brief handshake sufficed. Kitty had described Alex as almost joining their family, but this greeting was not exactly brotherly.
"What brings you to Morristown?"
Alex said now.
"I thought you were stationed in Connecticut. Are you on leave? Visiting family?" "After a fashion," Henry drawled. "The powers that be, by which I mean our mothers, have arranged for Miss Schuyler here and me to tie the knot."
Alex's face went blank.
"Tie the knot," he said, as if he didn't speak English.
"You know, get hitched, jump the sword, and become one, as they say in more refined circles."
His hand slipped dangerously low on Eliza's hip, and he patted her like he was inspecting a horse at the fair.
"You are looking at the dam of the next generation of the Livingston brood. Enjoy this waste now, because after 8 or 10 babies, it will be naught but a memory."
I...
Alex shook his head, looking downright miserable.
"I don't know what to say."
"How about commiserations? I mean, congratulations, ha ha.
He clearly couldn't bring himself to say it. Miss Schuyler.
The news was quite as much of a shock to me as it was to you, Eliza said, doing her best to keep her voice level. I learned of it only 2 days ago myself.
She forced herself to smile, but it felt like her cheeks were cracking.
You were coming to see me, you said. Had you some news you wished to share?
Oh, am I sensing a bit of history here? Henry said now. Am I spoiling the party, as it were? Never fear, Hamilton. There are plenty more in the sea, for you, at least. I'm stuck with this one forever.
Alex's head whipped back and forth between Henry's and Eliza's, as if he still couldn't believe what he was hearing. Eliza had a sudden urge to strike Henry Livingston, that oaf.
Your news, Colonel Hamilton,
she prompted, hoping for some kind of a miracle. Alex turned back to her. He looked at her for what seemed like an eternity, his blue eyes brimming with disbelief.
I was coming to tell you that I've received a posting, he said finally. A command.
A command? Eliza repeated. You are going into battle?
Alex nodded.
It is a great honor for me.
His eyes bored into hers, and it seemed as if he wanted to say more, but that was all he said. If Eliza went by what her father told her, or what she saw in certain paintings and prints, she would have thought battle was a man on horseback with a sword raised in the air and a standard flying behind him. But though she had been sheltered from the realities of war, she knew it was a much bloodier business than that. Why, think of poor Private Wallace and his missing leg. The idea that Alex was facing similar peril, or even worse, made her knees tremble inside her skirt, and she silently pleaded for Alex to tell her that he would never be in harm's way. But of course he wouldn't do that. He was too honest to lie to her. Finally, because it was getting awkward, Eliza spoke.
Yes, it is a great honor. Congratulations, Colonel. Your first command. How exciting.
She stared back at him, feeling herself tremble all over at the thought of him going to war.
If I cannot marry him, at least let me know that he is safe.
But aloud, all she said was,
When do you leave?
In 2 days,
Alex said, looking so distraught that she worried he would keel over.
2 days,
Eliza echoed.
What unfortunate timing, Henry's braying voice cut in, making both Alex and Eliza jump. You're going to miss the wedding.
27. Command Performance. 3rd New Jersey Regiment, Amboy, New Jersey, March 1780. Springtime. All across New Jersey, tender shoots of new grass reached for the sun. Amid the delicate green of new leaves, the purplish-pink flash of the first redbud blooms hinted at a change in the air. Birds gathering in the yellow forsythia appeared tethered to a cloud, as they heralded in a glorious new season with their songs. Along the post road, iced over puddles cracked like broken glass beneath the wheels of wagons delivering morning goods. But by mid-afternoon, the ice had melted into the muddy earth. The last few pockets of snow lingered in the northern shadows of barns, where the cows were full of milk, and the farm wives were busy making butter and cheese. The farmers sharpened their plows and oiled their harnesses. It wasn't time to plant yet, but soon, soon. It wasn't time to fight yet, either. That would come soon enough. After 3 days of consideration, General Washington had announced that Alex was to be given command of the 3rd New Jersey Regiment. Its previous commander, Colonel Elias Dayton, had been wounded in a skirmish on Bedloe's Island, when his raiding party ran afoul of a group of British soldiers making their way up the Kilvan Col north of Staten Island to sabotage activities in Newark Bay. During the melee, Colonel Dayton took a musket ball in his thigh. The wound festered, and gangrene set in before the leg could be taken. Lingering close to death for more than a week, Dayton finally succumbed.